Mid might bring his parents or her parents in, and then they'll say, oh, let's look at my record when I was here. And so, you know, we'll show them to them.
This is Preble Hall. Welcome to Preble Hall, a podcast about naval history from the United States Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis.
Welcome back. Our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Bryan, who I think has the longest title of anybody here at the Naval Academy, head of Special Collections and Archives and the Archivist, with a capital A.
Yes.
Dr. Jennifer Bryan, welcome back to Preble Hall. Always good to have you here.
Thank you.
What's your job?
Well, if that title didn't cover it, I am in charge of the rare books and manuscripts at the Academy, the printed ephemera, the photographs, and the official records of the Academy. The department is located in the library, so we only take paper-based material. The archives are an affiliated archive of the National Archives and Records Administration, so that's a special relationship that we have with the National Archives. I believe there are 10 affiliated archives. West Point is another. So essentially, the records of the Naval Academy belong to the National Archives. They are part of the Executive Department records that go to the National Archives, and we're Record Group 405. So being an affiliated archive means that the Academy is responsible for maintaining the collection and providing access to it, providing the staff to supervise, maintain, provide access, but the records themselves belong to the National Archives. So that's the archives portion of the Special Collections and Archives. Special Collections, we have 552 manuscript collections at this point. That is 552 collections that are available to researchers. They can be anything from the personal papers of someone like Admiral Reason or Admiral Gallery to collections of letters from somebody who served in the Civil War. We also have the journals that Franklin Buchanan kept when he was a midshipman, so our first superintendent. We have the journals that he kept aboard ship when he was a mid, because part of their training required that they keep a journal, which we use that in the naval sense. So it's essentially the log, but it's kept by an individual, so it's not the official ship's log. So when we talk about manuscripts in the Special Collections, we're not talking about illuminated manuscripts or anything like that. We're talking about modern manuscripts, so essentially personal papers. We also have approximately 30,000 volumes. We actually have 7 incunabula or incunable, meaning 7 books printed before 1501. Incunabula being the Latin for in the cradle. So that's
how. What are those books about?
Well, one of them is Caesar's commentaries on the Gallic Wars, history of the later Caesars. 2 are mathematical works. They were printed in the 1400s, yeah. Yes. So they would have been printed after roughly 1453. So I think the earliest one we have, I think, is 1487. That is a Bible. It's the Old Testament. As I recall, it's the first 5 books and then the prophets. That was published in Nuremberg, Germany, by Anton Koberger, who was essentially the heir to Gutenberg. He's sort of considered, I guess, the first publisher. So it's very, very interesting to have 7 works from such an early time in the collection of the Naval Academy.
How would those have arrived here?
All of those, if I am remembering correctly, all of those were gifts. I don't think any of those were purchased for the library, although certainly much of what's in Special Collections in the book collection is material that was purchased to be part of the library's collection. So we actually have works from even the 17th century that were purchased for use by the midshipmen, but of course when they were bought in the 1800s, wouldn't have seemed as old to us as they do today. But we have, for example, Newton's method of fluxions, which calculus, which sat on the stacks in the library for years and years and years. It's been rebound in Buckram, which is, you know, standard library binding. And yes, it sat on the open shelves until at one point somebody said, you know, that really ought not to be out there. So the incunabula come as gifts. We do get material as gifts, but also some of it we've purchased, and some of it's just material that's been in the library for, well, at this point, 175 years, because we do have the original the collection of books that made up the library of the Naval School. So,
now, we know that in the National Archives that there are laws that govern record keeping for members of Congress and the presidents. They all have to go to National Archives. What do you have to take in terms of Naval Academy materials here at Special Collections?
Well, what we have to take would only apply to the archives, to the official records. So that would be the what we refer to as the central files, which are the superintendent's records. The lucky bag, actually.
Which is the yearbook of the Naval
yearbook.
Academy.
The log, which is the midshipman's magazine. We also take reef points, which is that handy little guide that all the plebes get when they come to the academy. We also have the watch logs for Bancroft, going back to the 1845. The midshipmen are required to stand watch, so we have those. Commandant's records and midshipman records come to us. And as you can imagine, a lot of
those are the academic records.
They are actually their application to the school and their academic records and their conduct records. They vary depending on the year, the early records. For example, I mean, the school was founded in 1845, and of course, this is our 175th anniversary, so it originally wasn't a four-year course until 1851 when it became the Naval Academy. And so the early records are a little interesting. We had a board of examiners. And then when you go to the four-year course, what might appear in those early years would just be the conduct record. In 1858, you have the annual register of the academy that starts, publishing, that begins. And in the annual register, you have order of merit and grades. When you get to, say, Admiral Nimitz era, in that time period, they had to serve 2 years at sea after the four-year academic course, so we will have the records, their fitness reports when they were on the ship. As they finished the academic course, then they were still mids, they went for the 2 year sea service, came back, took an examination. That ended in 1912. Don't ask me when it started, I guess. It was the 1870s or 1880s.
Yeah, it had to have been, because Philo Giffen, for example, graduated in 1882.
Yeah.
He goes on a ship for 2 years and does not get his commission.
Right. There was no guarantee. So what is actually in the midshipman records will vary. The things that we get now are basically the oath of office and their final record when they leave, which is just conduct is not, there's not every single conduct violation isn't listed.
Oh, it's really? They don't have that? Like, so in the 18, so if you wanted to search for somebody in the 1890s, you could pull their record and you see each demerit they got in for what they got it for, what they got it for, but also who gave it to them.
Yes.
That is no longer available.
No, and that hasn't probably for the last, I don't know, maybe 50 years. You know, as I said,
we kind of lose something, though, in terms of historical research when you don't have that level of granularity.
Yes, that's true. And the thing that's interesting is, for example, with Admiral Moffett, we have Admiral Moffett's personal papers. He's first chief of the Bureau of Aeronautics and a graduate of the academy. So we have his personal papers. So included in his personal papers are his own diaries that he kept when he was a midshipman. And we had a class come in one time that looked at those and then pulled out his conduct record and saw what he was written up for and who wrote him up. And they could look at what he was writing in his journal about this particular person giving him a hard time. And here, you know, you can see it written up in the conduct record. So, yes, you do. I mean, we show when the plebes come through the library for their tour during plebe summer, and they come to our department, we only spend 5 minutes with them, and of course we don't expect them to remember much, but we put out some things for them to look at so that hopefully they at least remember those and can associate those things with where we're located on the third floor of the library. And one of those things that we put out is Admiral Nimitz's conduct record. So we can say to them, you too can be Fleet Admiral someday, because see, here's what he got in trouble for. And, you know, he wasn't actually particularly bad, but, you know, clearly he got written up, I think, on a few occasions for playing cards, which suggests gambling. And not following proper instructions for his exams, I think that was a couple times. And then things like spots on blouse and keeping the wardrobe door open and, you know, things that seem minor and are, but still get written up. So it's fun to see those.
Who can see those records?
Anything that's that early is open to the general public. The Department of Defense and the National Archives have an agreement that a record does not become public until 62 years after the person has been separated from the service. So someone like Jimmy Carter, we can now look at his record, although when I started here, you couldn't because that 62-year time period had not passed. So if you want to look at Halsey's record or Admiral Halsey or General Lejeune or somebody like that, those are open to the public. More recent graduates, you would have to have that person's permission, or if the person's deceased, you have to be a direct relative, what they call immediate relative. So some things you are just closed, and that's just that's because of the Privacy Act. Mm-hmm. So, but if say you're a mid here and you want to look at mom or dad's record, or dad write and say that's fine, then you know can look at it. And we actually have had, and obviously with COVID, everything's we don't have outside researchers, but in normal times, so around graduation, a mid might bring his parents or her parents in, and then they'll say, oh, let's look at my record when I was here. And so, you know, we'll show them to them.
You mentioned you had about 552 manuscript collections. Are there some that get a lot of use? You know, I think of somebody like, you know, you mentioned Franklin Buchanan, the first superintendent of the academy, and I know Craig Simons, a retired professor here and a wonderful naval historian, one of the best in the business, probably the best in the business right now. And Craig wrote a book on Franklin Buchanan. I'm sure he used that material. What are some of the other collections that really get some use?
Well, interestingly, we have William Sebald's papers, who was a graduate from, graduated in the 20s. I can't remember if it was 26, but He actually was a lawyer. He lived in Japan for a while prior to World War II, and then before World War II, he came back to the United States. He was a native of Baltimore, and he returned. He had married a woman in Japan, and then when the war started, he joined Naval Intelligence, and he ended up working with MacArthur in occupied Japan and went on to become an ambassador, and not to Japan, but to Malaysia, and I think it was New Zealand, Australia, or New Zealand. But anyway, because he was with MacArthur in Japan, actually his book's called With MacArthur in Japan, but I mean, because he was there during that time period, we've actually had several researchers from Japan and Korea come to look at his collection. And so that turns out to be one of the ones that has been used more so by outside researchers than the midshipmen. The midshipmen tend to use our collections. For example, we have battle action and ship reports from ship action reports and battle reports from World War II, and they tend to use those. And Civil War era material gets used. But it's often hard to predict. As a matter of fact, you just came and used the William Russell papers, which we didn't think anyone would ever use Professor Russell's papers.
So. I have to say, so Professor Russell was a history professor here from 1946 to 1973. And I went over to the archives, as you know, some of the professors do, and was just looking at wargaming in the 1980s, this old program, NAVTAG. Somebody told me about it, and you had two folders on it. Well, fortunately, and this is why I tell my midshipmen, you have to go to the primary sources, and that means talking to the reference librarians and the archivists. You have to go to the original sources, because this is something that might not catch in a catalog. And I walked in, and David D'Onofrio, who's the archivist, one of the archivists, I should say. He said, "Hey, you know, I know you were interested in war games. Did you know that there was a professor who was doing that in the 1960s? And I didn't know, obviously. And he brought out four or five boxes because this professor had saved not only the game that the midshipmen had developed, he saved all their evaluations. I mean, there was a lot more. This is the Russell collection is right. far greater than just that. But I ended up taking some of those names from class of 67, 68. I spoke to them last weekend.
Oh, okay.
I spent most of the weekend actually just interviewing them about this game. And it's going to be an article for Shipmate Magazine, which is a monthly publication of the Naval Academy Alumni Association. But I think that just really goes to show the value that you in terms of your office, bring to the Academy and understanding Academy history. I mean, Russell's papers aren't the only ones that are there. I mean, I think he kind of dumped, you know, probably tons of, probably a few trunk loads.
Well, I think basically, you know, clean out his office,
But not every professor does that.
No. We have Samuel Massey's papers. He was the first African-American professor at the Naval Academy.
When did he teach here?
I believe it was the 70s, 60s and 70s or 70s. I have to look that up, but we have his papers, we have Professor Russell's paper, we have Carol Storrs Alden's papers, he's earlier in the 20th century. So we do have some of the faculty's papers.
How many people do research on faculty papers? Like I just happened to do it on wargaming and a particular aspect of this professor, but it seems like that's kind of a gold mine in terms of understanding education at the Academy for the past 175 years is, what were they teaching? How were they teaching it? What were they reporting on?
Well, not many people do use the faculty's papers. That's why we were quite surprised and pleased that you were using Professor Russell's papers. The worthiness of those value of those collections depends, of course, on what's in them, and oftentimes it is just an instance of all this material was left in someone's office, and we take it in, and much of it turns out not to be particularly useful necessarily, but it's not our job to decide what's useful and what isn't. If we're given material, we what we call process it, which is arrange and describe it, and it's sort of like Field of Dreams. If you build it, they'll come. So that's why David and I were joking, well, here we thought nobody'd ever use Professor Russell's papers and our museum director's using it. So we try when the collections are offered to us, or I do purchase materials at times, we try to collect material that we think will be of value to the midshipmen in their studies or to what outside researchers might be interested in using. So,
how do you determine that, Jennifer?
Well, it's sort of just based on years of experience and having a sense of what is used and what isn't used. And so I can't point to anything that's written down, or it's just sort of a feel that one has.
And it's also a value to the midshipmen because, for example, I've got a history honors student whom I'm supervising, and he's writing it about his paper about John Ollick, who was a Commodore during the mid-19th century. And fortunately, we have all of Ollick's papers here.
Right.
If you were to receive a midshipman who said, "Dr. Brian, I don't know what I want to do my research paper on, but you know, do you have any thoughts? Is there anything that is understudied or underutilized in the archives collection about Naval Academy history primarily, or generally about naval history?"
Well, I've thought it would be interesting, and my area of expertise is colonial and revolutionary America, so, and I'm not saying that isn't done, but so when I say that I think an area that would be interesting to study as far as the Navy, I'm not certain that I'm the one who knows for sure whether it's a area that has been less studied, because I'm not, that's not my personal area. But if that made sense, that was, but it seems to me that the relationship of the U.S. Navy with South America would be of interest, especially in the 19th century. I mean, we do have ships' logs from ships that were on that station. I don't know how much you can derive from those, but we also have some collections that relate to people who served in that area. It would just seem to me that that is a potential area of study that maybe hasn't received a lot of attention. As I said, again, my 19th century naval history is not my area of expertise, but it seems that might.
What about in terms of the Naval Academy's history? Because you've been here since when?
2001. Actually, Thursday is my 19th anniversary.
Yeah, so you've been here 19 years working with this collection, and you have a pretty good sense of all the people who have come in to do research. And I'm always kind of curious, whenever I go to National Archives, as I have over the years to write different books or other things for Naval Intelligence, I'm always curious. You know, you see this big room full of researchers, and I remember, you know, 20 years ago, just asking the reference desks, you know, like, what are they researching? 70% of them at that time were ship's logs because they were looking at asbestos claims. So these were all paralegals.
Oh, sure.
And a few years ago, I was over at National Archives in College Park, and, you know, it was the majority of people, the researchers were Asian. And so I just kind of asked the reference desk, well, what are generally people looking at right now? I said, well, most of the people you see right now are from China, and they're photocopying everything they can from recently released World War II or early Cold War material.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see that this large effort in gathering information for different purposes. But in terms of the people that have come through, you kind of get a sense of what has or hasn't been done about Naval Academy history, because there have been several books written now about Naval Academy history.
Right.
Is there anything you think that hasn't been covered in Academy history?
Well, that's an interesting question. My sense is that the histories, I think Jack Sweetman's the only one who has written a general history of the Academy through it. This entire that was published the 80s or the 90s?
Yeah, so that was a while ago.
So that's the only recent history I can think of that covers the entire lifespan of the Academy, because certainly the early Academy has received attention of late. I know that there are at least two books that have been published, I think, in the last 10 years, which were on trying to start up the Academy, and because of course there were many efforts to have a Naval Academy comparable to the Military Academy. It just took them a lot longer to get around to it. So it would seem to me that, and I think there are books about Navy football, but I don't know that anyone has written much just on the late 19th century or early 20th century Academy. I don't know that there's been a lot done on that, and that would be possible. We unfortunately do have a gap in our records in the central files, which I mentioned are the superintendent's records. We do have a gap from roughly 1930 to 1960, and that doesn't mean we don't have any records from those years, but we don't have the nice, organized, complete files for those times.
So a lot of the decisions that some of the soups would have been making at that time is a bit spotty.
Yes.
Especially with the ramp up to World War II.
Yes, which is very unfortunate. And I don't know what happened. There's actually a folder that has a sheet of paper in it that says the records were destroyed. And I just have a vision of some room somewhere in a building being full of boxes and someone coming along and saying, what is all this stuff? We need this space. Get this out of here, and whoever it was not realizing what it was. Now, I don't know that that's what happened, but at the time that would have happened, the Academy archives had not yet been established, so the records would have gone to the National Archives at that time. So,
No, I'd have to agree with you. That 1880s to, say, 1910 period there's so much rich material, because you have so many future admirals coming out of that period.
Right.
You have the changes in the Navy. I mean, this semester in my naval history classes, each student has taken a class year, and they are studying that class year, some of the people who came out of it, what their actions were, but also life at the academy during it. Because, again, you know, Sarah Phillips was just in here talking about the Ernest Flagg period, where the Naval Academy really does come into its own with these major construction projects of Bancroft Hall and Mahan and the Third Chapel.
Right, and I think that the records that we have would support study of that period, and as you said, there's so many that came out of those years: Ernest King, Nimitz, Halsey. You have Lejeune, of course, who goes into World War I, and you've got Moffett, who sadly died in the Akron. But a lot of naval officers from that time period. So it would be, I think it would be a fruitful area to study for academy history. And we do have manuscript collections. We have midshipman manuscript collections, we call them. We have a number of digital collections. So we have the digital collection is called Midshipman Manuscript Collections, where we have taken some of those personal collections that I mentioned that happened to be letters home that the mids were writing. And we have ones from the Civil War era, and we also have ones from the early 20th century. I can't remember if we have anything from the late 19th century other than perhaps some notebooks that they produced for their classes. But David D'Onofrio, who you mentioned, who's the Special Collections Librarian, is the one who's responsible for arranging and describing the manuscript collections. And so he produces what we call finding aids, which are available online, which help researchers know what's in a collection and whether it's worth looking at. So you get span dates, something about the person who created the documents, what kinds of documents are in there. And I should give a shout out to all of my staff. So
please do.
So Sam Limnios is the assistant archivist, and he just recently created this interactive map for the 175th anniversary. So
that is a fantastic map. We've started distributing that, and if folks go, I guess where would the best place to get it?
Well,
is it online?
It is online, and I don't know if we have our link up yet or not. If you go to the library's Facebook page, you'll find the link there, and also on the Twitter feed, the link is to the map. And we will have a link on I think we would like to put it on the main library page. It'll also be on the Special Collections and Archives page.
So basically, what he's done is he's taken a map of today, of the Academy, but also as you scroll over it, you will see certain points of photos from the 19th century and what it looked like from that vantage point.
Yes, and he did a lot of work in trying to figure out where you would be standing and where this building would be. And actually, I said to him, it has actually helped me, because even though I'm familiar with looking at a lot of these photographs, having been here all these years, when you're walking across the yard, a little stone marker in the ground that says this is where old quarters was or new quarters, it doesn't really, you don't really understand quite how it was laid out. So I thought, this was his idea that he came up with while we were teleworking, and I think that it's been a great. So it's our contribution to the 175th anniversary. And I should also mention, so there's Sam and there's David and there's also Adam Minikowski, who works half time in the Special Collections and Archives Department. The other half he works for the Research and Instruction Department in the library. But Adam is responsible for the social media for the library, among other things, and he does cataloging and reference for us and in Special Collections and Archives. But and all of us contribute to our blog. We do, the Special Collections and Archives Department does have a blog, so we do write things in there. So,
and you've got this incredible collection of photographs.
Oh,
and
yes.
And I know on our Facebook and Twitter feed, we use your collection heavily. We also make sure to reference it.
Oh, yes.
It.
We appreciate that. Yes, I noticed that it'll say, from the Special Collections and Archives.
Yeah, because
so thank you.
Yeah. David and I were joking about this the other day because, a historian, like me going into your office, I don't discover anything that you all haven't already put together and made available for people like me. So that's why I thank you for what you all do, because you really are the heart of Naval Academy history. It all goes back to that. We can't do what we do without you, the students, the faculty. I want to go back to the essence of getting collections, because you now have a period of American history in the 2020s where midshipmen communicate, you know, by email, by text, or whatever, and nobody's really writing letters anymore, and we're missing out on something. Do you think that there's a way to get around that? I mean, 100 years from now, if somebody is studying about the Naval Academy life, they won't be able to go to a text or an email. You know, it's going to be go by the wayside, like you and I grew up, you know, listening to 8-track cassettes or something.
Yeah, right.
You know, you know, my midshipman, I showed that the other day to my midshipman.
They
had
no clue what
it was. What is this antique?
Yeah.
But how do you address something like that? Is that a concern for somebody who's an archivist and trying to capture a period of academy life and history?
Well, yes, because there's no... I mean, with the official records, obviously the electronic records still have to be maintained. So when it comes to the official records, there will still be documentation in that area. But when you're talking about midshipmen letters or diaries or that sort of thing, I really don't know what is going to happen, because there's no, as I said, with the official records, there's you are compelled to keep them, because that's obviously how you tell you want to keep them, and you're compelled to keep them, so you have a record of what was going on. But with personal papers, yes, I mean, there's no compulsion to keep anything like that. And so I don't really know what repositories will do in the future. I mean, in some ways, it's almost... It might be going back to the way things were in the medieval period, when you had only what the monks copied out, or the scriptoria copied, and what else, and things that might have been saved by certain people, but the bulk of material, there are a lot of gaps, and it might ironically be similar in this modern era. Actually, that's a really good question, because I hadn't really thought about the personal papers angle before, because sure, I mean, they just text. They don't even do email, really. I mean, and that's the thing that's been really interesting to me, because as I said, I started in 2001, and the way technology has changed even in these 19 years. When I started, things were still photocopied, and we wouldn't photocopy the rare books because it would damage them to put them on the photocopier. With the advent of the phones with cameras, the smartphones, even the digital camera prior to that was the smartphone. Now it's just, yeah, sure, take your phone out and take a picture of it. It's fine. And with scanning and all of that sort of thing. So when I started, the email would have been the thing. Now it's texting, right? So I don't really know what's going to happen as far as the personal side, because it's very interesting to read the letters of people who were attending here, and some of the MIDs wrote every day, which I don't know how they had time or where they found the time. And you see that even in, not even here at the Academy, but just letter writing in general. So that's a good question, Claude. I really don't know what's going to happen.
You get a real value in working on my dissertation on the 1830s Navy and getting these, going up to, oh, shoot, is it Hagley, where the DuPont papers were located,
yes,
up in Delaware?
Right.
And, you know, probably 20 or 30 boxes of Samuel DuPont letters, later becomes an admiral during the Civil War. But as a junior officer is writing, so you get a real sense of what's going on in the minds of the junior officers at this time.
Right.
You don't get that sense today. I don't know if you get that sense from 30 or 40 years ago either. I don't know what is donated, because, you know, you and I both have experienced this. And we experienced this at the museum with the 40th anniversary of Women Admitted to the Academy when we did that exhibit a few years ago, is that we don't have a lot of items from female graduates. And the reason why is people tend not to donate to a museum or an archive until really they have retired,
right.
They're older, they're probably toward the end of their life, or their family has unfortunately suffered because of the loss, and they are donating their items. So we're not quite at that point where the women who graduated in 1980 and onward have donated any items to us. And I'm sure you've experienced this as well.
Yes, absolutely. It is, as you said, it's usually somebody who's at the end of their career, a person who's older and clearing out the house, or a family who has suffered a loss and then turning the material over. So yes, we don't really have much material, even from the Vietnam era, but Korea, we have more. We've been getting more from Korea, but not from the Korean era. But yes, we don't have a whole lot from the Gulf War or this more recent time period, or as you said, from women at the Academy. We don't have a lot because people, I think that's just human nature. You don't think about any of this until you are older, and then you think, well, wait a minute, maybe I should do something with these materials that I have. I also think, and you could confirm that perhaps, but the naval officers don't necessarily keep a lot of, they don't have a lot of space, so they don't necessarily keep a lot of papers. They don't have, I mean, some of them do, but I think when they're in mid-career, probably not so much. So,
and they're traveling a lot too.
Yeah.
What are some of the coolest things? And you take that definition broadly, but what are some of the coolest things people would find in special collections and archives?
Well, I actually, before I came over, I was just trying to think of some things. So, and I made a note to myself because that movie, The Good Shepherd, just came out recently. And people probably wouldn't realize that we have a number of C.S. Forrester manuscripts, one of them being The Good Shepherd. These were, he wrote them out longhand on legal pads and had them bound usually in leather and given to his friend Francis Phillips, who was an editor at William Morrow and Company. And they had a friendship, and then she donated this material to the library. But we have several of the Hornblower books in manuscript. When we have The Good Shepherd in manuscript, which I was going to write a blog post about, but I didn't do it in a timely fashion, so it didn't tie in with the release of the movie. And also, she not only did she have the manuscripts, but he would often send her a copy of the book when it was published, and then she would paste in it or write in it the press run, and maybe a newspaper clipping that was a review of the book. So that's an interesting collection that is really interesting to see how he wrote, to see an author, especially going back to the technology thing, because authors today obviously are using a computer, so you don't necessarily see all the changes they make. He's written this all out in ink has a very small hand, has written it out on the legal pad. Places words are crossed out and something's penciled over it. I imagine it's probably the final manuscript draft before it was typed up for the printer, for the publisher. But so it's just interesting to see an author at work. So that would be, I guess, a cool thing. I don't know.
that's a good point, because we have a copy, and I think the original is in archives, but it's a paper from 1952. James Lovell wrote a paper, and it's on the liquid fuel rocket. And this is, right, you know, a decade and a half before he goes on manned space missions, most right, famously on Apollo 13. But you see the handwritten notes on there from Professor E.B. Potter and another professor. You can't get that today.
No.
We don't print. I this is the first semester I haven't printed up any kind of papers or exams.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't keep them after a while anyway.
Right. So that's something that, you know, you don't really get to see the author at work. Or as you said, with the paper, the comments of the professor on the paper.
That goes to back to the value of when I was over there last week, looking at the war games, and you have these student evaluations of the games themselves, but you also have some handwritten notes from both the professor and the students.
Right.
And fortunately, we had those, or I could not have spoken to those people who are now in, class 67, 68, they're in their late 70s now, they're right, long since retired. But when I spoke to them, they still had, the memories were like yesterday of this particular course and this professor.
Right.
So you're able to tie in all these things from the Naval Academy history, the people, the faculty,
Yeah, and that's, I think that's an important and is something that we are going to lose. And I don't know how, I don't think there's anything we can do about it. It's just the technology. You're mentioning the handwritten comments and so forth reminds me also that we have a, this is going to be a roundabout way to get to this, but we have a collection that's of books about, I think they're about 1,100 books given by Park Benjamin, who was an 1867 graduate of the Naval Academy. He resigned upon graduation, but he went on to edit, to be the editor of Scientific American. He wrote several books on electricity. Actually, one of his daughters married Enrico Caruso, so.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, and.
But he's famous for designing something.
Oh, well, yes, he is famous for designing something, but I was going to mention also that in his collection, many of the works are early, so we're talking mostly 17th and 18th century works on electricity and magnetism. There are actually at least one of the incunabula that I mentioned is in his collection. There are some, even some books from the 1500s in there, and some from later period, but they're all very important. There's Franklin, Volta, Aldini, Galvani, anyone who was involved in studying electricity and magnetism. And the reason I bring up Galvani is because he did the experiments with frogs' legs, and he came up with the idea of animal electricity, which, of course, then determined that that really didn't exist. But it led to Volta coming up with the idea of the battery. And even though Galvani, what Galvani originally thought he was observing, turned out not to be the case, it also, he influenced using electricity and medicine and that sort of thing. But we have the printing of his paper on his experiments with frogs' legs, in which his corrections, his handwritten corrections, are in it. So, I mean, that's got to be the only one in the world. So, I mean, not that his paper wasn't published elsewhere, but to have his corrections in his handwriting. And because it's October, Galvani's also interesting in the connection with Frankenstein, because his nephew Aldini did the experiments actually with prisoners who had been hanged, and he did in experiments in London. So, and I don't know that there's, the last year, because that was the anniversary, it was just last year, wasn't it? It was the anniversary of the publication of Frankenstein. Noah Comet, who's a professor here in the English department, had put together a program, and I had great fun going through the works that we have that are related, that I could tie into the book, and so a lot of those came from the Benjamin collection. But anyway, that's a digression.
But, I should go back to Benjamin
the,
Park.
Right.
What was he famous for?
Yeah, the Park Benjamin actually designed the Academy's crest. So the University Club in New York was being constructed at the time, and they were putting the crests of various schools on the building, and the Academy didn't have one, so he designed it, yes. So, which has our trireme and excientia tridens, and so from Sea Power Knowledge. So, yes, that's, he designed it. And then we actually have a letter in the collection that relates to an article that was published in Proceedings about the crest, because I won't remember it exactly because I didn't look at it right before I came over here, but the article in Proceedings apparently had some inaccuracies in it in regard to the creation of the Academy's crest. So Park Benjamin was writing to explain why that wasn't accurate. And when there was the change of command, and the Secretary of the Navy actually used that letter, some comment in that letter, because I think there's something where he kind of knocks the military academy, Benjamin does. So, but anyway, it's interesting to have that. So again, you have something, an article that was published about the Naval Academy crest. You have the one who created it writing and saying, you've got this not quite right. So, you know. Benjamin, I think, was probably a very interesting person. He wrote all his children out of his will at the end of his life. So, and I've been interested, at some point in time, I'd like to do something more with him. But I'm sure, as you know, a lot of times our what we would like to do with the collections that we supervise, we can't, because we also have administrative mm-hmm. duties and obviously have to provide the material to the people who come in to use it. So
absolutely, yeah. Because as you know, we have a lot of manuscripts here as well, and not only Navy manuscripts and Navy journals, et cetera, but we also have correspondence going back to 1845, and all of my predecessors have their correspondence in our file room. And I've been slowly going through those to get a really good sense of the Naval Academy history and another organization that I've been studying.
I would just mention that one of the projects that I've been working on that somewhat ties into the 175th anniversary is trying to gather all the books that were in the library prior to the Civil War. We have about 3/4 of our original library, which I think is interesting since we're an undergraduate institution. We're not Harvard, we're not Yale, so weren't necessarily thinking about keeping books. Libraries obviously cull material because they have to have current material, and if things aren't used, they're removed from the collections. So to have roughly 3/4 of the books that have been in the library since the catalog, the one and only printed catalog, which was 1860, I think is pretty incredible. Also considering that the library's been in a number of different buildings, not just here at the Academy, mm-hmm. but moved to Newport and back during the Civil War. So I've been working on that in trying to determine, there were a lot of those books were still in the general collection because they're not particularly rare. They're just old. So I was amazed at all of that. And especially in the mathematical works, as we have some really interesting works in mathematics that now are rare because a lot of places, as I said, the libraries cull things. So, but that's just been an interest of mine. And so hopefully someday I'll be able to write something about it. But not that anybody would necessarily be interested in it, you know, except the bibliophile, but that's my little pet project. So,
well, Dr. Jennifer Bryan, head of special collections and archives and the archivist. Jennifer, thanks. Always good to see you.
Oh,
I really appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you.
And for our listeners, if you enjoyed the program, please leave feedback, whatever platform you listen to. And please use Special Collections and Archives. It is a gold mine of information about the Academy. You can always learn something. Thanks a lot and have a great day.
Preble Hall is in no way intended to reflect the official positions of the Department of the Navy or the Naval Academy.